I'm Emmanuel Berry in for Mark Bayshore. This is Current State. Coming up later on our show, we'll hear from spoken word artist Sarah Kay. She's a world-renowned poet and founder of Project Voice, an initiative to teach spoken word to youth around the world. Also, we'll preview the MSU College of Music's Latin is America celebration. But first, late last month, the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, ruled that football players at Northwestern University qualify as employees under federal law and can therefore unionize. The decision has been divisive. While some applaud the move to provide players with more rights and financial compensation, others fear that the collegiate athletic system will be destroyed by the move. This week, Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon co-authored an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal against unionizing players. To break down this case, we are joined today by Robert and Amy McCormick. Both are Michigan State law professors emeritus. Together, they've produced years of scholarship focusing on athletes and their relationship to the NCAA, including the often cited Law Review, The Myth of the Student Athlete, The College Athlete as Employee. Amy and Robert, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Robert, you're an expert in labor law, but what made you decide to focus your legal expertise on the issue of college athletes?
Well, it's an interesting story. It started really about 10 years ago. Amy and I were watching the men's basketball tournament, March Madness. We're big Spartan fans, and we kept noticing that the NCAA would run these advertisements in which they emphasized that the athletes at the various schools would be going pro in something else. That was the standard line at that point. They have a new one now, which indicates that the NCAA is there as kind of cheerleaders and backup for the athletes themselves. And we noticed that this ad would run repeatedly, many, many times during the course of the tournament. And we began to wonder why that would be the case. Why would the NCAA run this public relations bit over and over again, because of course that advertising space is very, very expensive. Mm-hmm. And so they weren't selling any products particularly. They weren't generating any particular revenue from this. And we began to wonder what is this? Why are we hearing this over and over again, that these young people are going to go pro in something else other than their sports? At the same time, Amy was reading the biography of Walter Byers, who was a longtime executive director of the NCAA for decades. After he retired, he wrote what I guess is a confessional in which he revealed that the NCAA had invented the term student athlete that we see everywhere now. Student-athlete, in response to a decision in the Colorado courts that held that a young man who had been a football player for his university and had been injured in the course of his football time there was an employee of the university, was entitled to workers' compensation for his job-related injuries. And the NCAA was very alarmed by this decision by the courts, and Byers immediately coined the term student-athlete and required every member of the NCAA to use that term exclusively when they're talking about scholarship athletes at their universities. And that piqued our curiosity. I had never really thought that they might be employees. It had never crossed my mind. And I thought, well, is that true? Was Colorado correct that this young man was an employee instead of a student? So we began to look into it. And we did our legal research as to what constitutes an employee. And concluded ultimately that there's no question in our minds that in fact they are employees.
Amy, let's kind of break down how you guys got to that conclusion. And I think a good place to start is with the national with the board's decision regarding Brown University. Okay. And their TAs.
Yes. Brown University had a situation where research assistants and teaching assistants wanted to unionize, wanted better working conditions, maybe better pay, And they tried to unionize, and Brown University, the institution, opposed that move. And that culminated in a decision by the NLRB, which looked at what standard exists to decide whether someone is an employee. In this case, a student is an employee of the university. And the Brown Board, by that I mean the NLRB, when it decided the Brown case, it did a two-part analysis. First, it looked to the common law definition of employee, which looks to whether the in this case the student provides services for Brown University in exchange for compensation, and do they do that under the control or right of control of the university. That means, does the university have the right to determine how the student goes about performing the services? And so that those three elements are part of the common law right of control test, which the Brown Board used in assessing whether these students were employees. Then the board also went on and said, when it comes to students at a university, we are going to look beyond the sole common law test. We're going to look at, in addition, we're going to look at what is the relationship between the student and the university. Maybe these students are providing their services as part of their education. And if so, we shouldn't just look to whether they provide services in exchange for compensation and whether they are under the control of the university in terms of how they provide those services. And so the board said, when we do this extra analysis for students, we are going to ask, what are the students in providing those services, is their relationship with the university primarily academic or something else, more primarily economic or primarily commercial? And to simplify things a bit, the more commercialized the relationship is between the student and the university, the less primarily academic it is, the more likely the board would decide that these are employees. So if you meet both the common law three-part test that I described earlier, and if you can say that the relationship between the two parties is primarily commercial and not primarily academic, then yes, that person will be viewed as an employee. And we took this very test, this two-part test, and asked ourselves, how does this apply to athletes? And we limited our analysis to football players and men's basketball players at Division I schools, the revenue-generating sports,
yeah,
because of what Brown said about the relationship having to be commercial. You can look at all student athletes, and they probably all meet the common law test for being an employee. They all provide athletic services in exchange for their athletic scholarship, which can be pulled if they stop playing their sport. And they are under massive control by the university. So all athletes at those schools probably meet the common law test for being an employee. But when it comes to the extra tests set out in Brown requiring a commercial relationship, that's harder to prove when you're talking about a tennis player, mm-hmm, or a soccer player or a wrestler. But it's very present when you're talking about a football player or a men's basketball player. And so we came to the conclusion, for a number of reasons, after looking at the facts of the situation, that these guys really do constitute employees under those tests.
I think a lot of people, Robert, would say they're student athletes. They're students. How is this an economic relationship? Can you kind of expand upon that a little bit and put into context for us how much these sports are commercialized and the money being made off of them?
Yeah, we really, neither of us played college sports, so we were really unaware of, the daily lives of these young men. And so we spoke to a number of them. We interviewed a number of current and former athletes at basketball players and football players at Division I schools, a variety of schools. And we were really, I think we were both really surprised at the level of control that is exercised over their lives. It's just pervasive. Many times these young men will work 40, 50, 60 hours a week doing their athletic-related activities. it just simply doesn't leave time for a young person to put all that work into their sport and actually undertake an intellectual endeavor to study in an intellectual sense the studies that they might otherwise take up. So that surprised us, and we were quite surprised that at the level of control. In fact, I would say that there's more control over these young men than any other employee at the university. nobody ever asked us to get up at 5:30 and lift weights and do all of the things that they have to do. And of course, you asked specifically about the commercial aspect of it, and I think probably this audience will know that. Football and men's basketball are enormously lucrative enterprises, college sports multi-billion dollar industry. In Michigan State alone, the athletic budget is over $80 million, and that is all generated by football, primarily football, but also men's basketball players. Unlike soccer or softball or wrestling, and all of these athletes work very hard. They work very, very hard for their sports. There's no question in my mind about it. But we couldn't make the argument that it was that they were primarily here for commercial purposes. On the other hand, or by contrast, I guess we concluded that the football players and the men's basketball players were at the university not primarily for their education. Not primarily for their academic advancement or their intellectual development, but primarily to field winning football and men's basketball teams. So with that conclusion, really the outcome in our minds was unavoidable, that that they meet all of the standards of the common law test, the three-part standard that Amy just described. They are here primarily, unlike teaching assistants or research assistants, who are basically advancing their own intellectual interests when they're doing their work, as in the Brown case. These young men are not here primarily for that purpose. They're not primarily here to advance their education. They're here primarily for their athletic ability. That's not to say that some of them don't get an education and some of them don't go on and do good things and advance their minds and so forth in the process. But we're talking about their primary purpose here. And given the demands on their time and their efforts and their energy, we could not conclude they were primarily here to advance their education.
And speaking with Robert and Amy McCormick, law professor, emeritus law professors at Michigan State University, they've written a lot of groundbreaking work and scholarship on the legal status of student athletes. There's been a lot of concern over the decision to allow the Northwestern players on the football team to unionize. Some are saying this is the end of college sports as we know it. Is it the end?
far from it.
we don't believe so.
Yeah, far from it. First of all, there are enormous sums of money involved, and college sports is very popular. We love it too. We're season ticket holders, and we'll be there in the fall. And so people love sports, and we love sports, and there's no reason to think that this will damage it in any way. And really, I think there's such a tremendous misunderstanding about the significance of this decision, because let's assume for the moment, and that's they're pretty big assumptions, that the regional director's decision gets upheld on appeal and the board affirms it and the Court of Appeals affirms it and the players actually vote to join the union, because we haven't had the vote yet.
After all of this?
After all of that, right. They may vote no, they don't want the union, in which case the whole thing goes away. But let's assume all of those things happen. the decision's upheld, and the players vote to join the union. All that that means is that Northwestern University would have to sit down and negotiate with the players regarding certain subject matters. It doesn't mean they'd have to give in on anything or change their position in any way. It just requires that management bargain with organized labor over certain subject matters. So the union has made it quite clear that they're not going to undertake some proposal that will put the university out of compliance with NCAA rules. That would be foolhardy.
So, I mean, what are they asking for then?
Go ahead.
They're asking for better medical coverage, including for injuries that they get from football after they graduate. The way things stand right now, someone could get a very bad injury that causes them problems down the line that requires multiple surgeries. And once their eligibility is over, they're really they're on their own unless Northwestern decides to be generous and cover them. But Northwestern doesn't have to do that. So they would like some better guarantees in terms of medical coverage. They would like to have independent people on the sidelines to consider experts on concussions. That's something that people involved in that union have been asking for informally from the NCAA and from conferences for at least 10 years and haven't gotten anywhere. But that's one of the things that they're asking for. They would like for athletes, and this would require an NCAA rule change, so they won't get this unless the NCAA changes their rules. They would like for athletes to be able to profit off of their likeness or image. Right now, the athletes have to sign away that right that most people have in their image, so that the only people who can profit off the athlete's likeness or image are the schools and the NCAA. They would like to change that. An athlete would like to be able to run a camp during summer. If it's a wrestler, I mean, we're not talking about wrestlers, but if it's a wrestler, they'd like to run a wrestling camp during the summer and to be able to earn some money to, cover some of their other expenses. They'd like to reform scholarships so that it includes the entire cost of attending the university. Right now, the athletic scholarships are limited, and they fall short by a couple thousand dollars a year of what it really takes to go to school. And that's a hardship for some of these players.
One other thing I think they're looking for, and neither of us is involved with the union. we just wrote the article. But one other thing they're looking for, I think, is the opportunity for the young men to be able to return to campus after their playing days are over, so they can actually complete their studies cost-free. So the scholarship would be not just their years of eligibility, but give them an opportunity when they're not spending 40, 50 hours a week
playing
football.
So they can be a student
athlete. So they could be a student athlete, right. And with the emphasis on student.
And student in that case.
Most people don't realize that those scholarships can be pulled.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on this for sure. Robert and Amy McCormick are law professors emeritus at Michigan State University. Together, they've written a groundbreaking scholarship on the legal status of student athletes. Amy and Robert, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
It was a pleasure.
Sarah Kay is a spoken word artist, teacher, and author. She's performed her poetry around the country, including at the Lincoln Center and the United Nations. Her TED Talk has gathered hundreds of thousands of views. Sarah is also co-director of Project Voice, which teaches spoken word poetry in schools worldwide. Last week, she stopped in East Lansing for a workshop at the Residential College in the Arts of Humanities. We also welcomed her to Studio S, where she explained how she entered the world of spoken word under mysterious circumstances.
Poetry has been a part of my life forever and ever, but performance was not a part of my life at all. And I had no background in theater, no real interest in being a performer. I was very self-conscious, had a lot of body image issues, as young girls are wont to have. And when I was 14, I got a letter in the mail that said, "Dear Sarah Kay, you have been registered to compete in the New York Teen Poetry Slam. And to this day, I don't know who registered me for that event.
Fate?
I call it divine intervention. Yeah. You would think at this point someone might have owned up, but
it's
they
been a
haven't.
While.
Yeah, it's been a while, you know. But they haven't, so the world will never know. But I certainly did not sign myself up. My parents, my teachers, nobody knew anything about it. And the only reason I said yes was because I liked poems. And I thought, well, this could be a fun thing to do with poems. And I went to my first poetry slam. And it was fairly terrifying. I'd really never performed much anything before. And the actual experience of performing my first poem was more awful than not. I was scared. I was shaking. My voice sounded about as bad as it sounds right now. I was kind of sick at the time. So the experience of performing was not particularly enjoyable. But after I was done performing and had sort of breathed my sigh of relief, a girl in the audience came and found me and tapped me on the shoulder, and she was at least 3 years older than I was, and infinitely cooler than I was. And she said, hey, I just want you to know I really felt that poem. And that is what I attribute as being the lightning strike that caused me to really fall in love with this art form, is that at the time I had never had an experience like that where something I had created had moved someone enough to reach out and let me know that. And that was a very powerful thing that I wanted to reach out for more of.
I think some people understand spoken word, or when they hear spoken word poetry, they think it's just a written poem that you read out loud. Is there a distinction, and what makes spoken word spoken word?
The way that I think about spoken word poetry is a poem that needs to be performed, that something about that poem demands that it be taken off the page and witnessed in person. And another way of thinking about that is that if you were to take that poem and leave it on the piece of paper, that it would lack some of the meaning, or you would miss out on something that the poet wanted you to understand. That something about the performance allows you to communicate more of the meaning that you're going for.
You started Project Voice at age 17, and it's a movement that encourages young people to engage through spoken word poetry. Why use spoken word poetry as a means to engage with youth?
Well, I fell in love with spoken word poetry when I was 14, and it had such a tremendous effect on my growth and my discovery of identity and my confidence and my empowerment, all of it. I would not be the person I am today at all if I had not discovered this art form. And on a very simple, very, very basic level, it was immensely validating to be 14 and to feel like I could, if I could articulate myself in a creative way about something that I cared about and present it passionately in a way that moved others, I would be rewarded with a room full of people, and oftentimes a room full of adults who would listen to me, which is pretty big when you're 14. And not only would they listen to me, they would clap. And not only would they clap, but sometimes someone would come and find me and say, hey, I really felt that poem. And I think that I cannot emphasize strongly enough how powerful of an experience it was for me, and how I believe that there are plenty of kids who could benefit from that same experience of learning that their voice is valid, that their opinions matter, that someone wants to listen to them, that they are worth celebrating. A lot of that is what I'm going for with Project Voice.
What does opening up and sharing these stories do for a person? I mean, how have you seen people change from doing it? Or how do you think you changed from kind of bearing all and becoming a storyteller?
Certainly something amazing that I've learned is that in crafting these stories that are often really personal and sharing them with the world, when I meet people who have seen my poetry in videos online, for example, even if it's my first time meeting them, they know a lot about me, or they know a lot about the type of person that I present myself to be, let's say that. So I often get to skip a lot of small talk that I don't like and no one needs, you know? It's almost like I get to enter a conversation halfway in already, which is cool. I like that a lot. I think it allows me to make slightly more meaningful connections with people more rapidly than I might otherwise be able to. So just on a personal level, I think I have been excited about the ability to meet people and interact with them in a real way, or what feels like a pretty real way. That's pretty cool. For others, the benefit of telling a story or telling their stories and sharing themselves, there's so many benefits. A big one that I talk about, especially in schools, is that it allows us to talk about things that are more personal than a textbook, especially aspects of ourselves and aspects of society that are otherwise often seeped in shame. So a really easy example is divorce. You have the opportunity to have a young person write a poem about their parents' divorce, share that in front of a room full of their peers, and have those peers go, "Whoa, I'm experiencing the same thing. I didn't realize I wasn't the only one." And that's a particularly powerful and important thing for young people, is to remember that they aren't alone.
They're not alone.
Yeah.
When you sit down to write or create a poem, do you set out with the intent of telling a particular story, or does sometimes the story just forms as you're getting everything out?
I write poems to figure things out. It is almost like a problem-solving strategy for me, that the only consistent thing across all of the poems I've ever written is that I have sat down to write a poem when I have something that I am struggling to understand or navigate, and it really is helping me work through something to write this poem. That being said, oftentimes I'm not even sure what it is I'm trying to figure out until I'm already halfway into the poem or finished with the poem, and then I look back and go, "Oh, that's what I was working on." So the answer is, sometimes I am like, "Yeah, this is the thing I'm trying to figure out. This is what I want to work on. This is the story I want to tell." Other times I have fragments of lines and thoughts and images and ideas and moments, and I'm stringing them together and moving them around. And then afterwards I go, oh, right. This is what my brain was trying to tell me.
I imagine that since being 14 years old and writing about, you know, your angst, that the type of poetry or the subjects you're interested in have changed. How have they changed?
When I was a kid, I was most often surrounded by boys. So I'm very close with my little brother. I said I'm close with my dad. All of my best friends were boys. And so it took me a very long time to wrap my head around the idea that I was one day going to be a woman. And it was very hard for me to understand. And it took me a long time to accept that, and then it took me even longer than that to be ready to talk about it or write about it in any way. And so something that's very new to me is thinking about and struggling with and trying to navigate womanness. That's something that was not a part of my early poetry. Although weirdly, when I said that to someone recently, they said, "That surprises me because I think your poetry, your older poetry is so gendered, that it is like so much from a young girl," which I don't know if that's true or not. That's just the opinion of one person. But I found that surprising, because to me, it's only recently that gender has started to really play a part in what I'm thinking about.
Well, Sarah, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Sarah Kay is a spoken word artist and co-founder of Project Voice. There are plans to build a new center here at MSU that, if realized, proponents say could have a substantial economic impact on the state of Michigan, including the creation of potentially thousands of new jobs. Current state producer Joe Lindstroth is here to tell us more.
That's right, Emmanuel. According to Chris Peterson, an agricultural economist and the head of MSU's Product Center, there are more than 600 mid-sized food processors in the state of Michigan. That's a significant number. And many of these companies' facilities are maxed out, meaning that if they want to create a new product, they don't have the capacity to test that product or the new manufacturing and packaging techniques to see if they're economically viable. So to address this, the MSU Product Center is looking to create a new food processing and innovation center, which will be equipped with all the machinery, the industrial freezers, the packing equipment, etc., for these companies to come in and test their new products. It will be unlike any other in the nation, says Peterson. Now, they're still raising the funding for the estimated $5.5 million project, and it's expected to consist of a mix of federal and state dollars, along with a commitment from MSU and five industry partners. And the facility will be located out on Hewlett Road near Hagedorn and Jolly. When I spoke with Chris Peterson, who's leading this effort to build the new Food Processing Innovation Center, he says that the capability of food processing companies to develop new products varies with the size of the company.
If you're a Kellogg or you're a Gerber, you, in fact, have your own pilot and scale-up facilities. And so you're doing a lot of research and development on a lot of different products all the time. So you have your own facilities. But for most more medium-sized firms, particularly firms that fall into the category of about $5 to $20 million of sales, about 10 to 50 employees, very often, their current production facilities are completely filled with their current set of products that they're running. And so either they have to take a line out of operation, and which can be very costly in order to do any kind of experimentation, or perhaps they can go to a larger processor and ask for the ability to use some off-peak times for that processor. But again, that's a very scarce resource. Or you literally do all of the planning on a piece of paper, and then you decide you're going to make the full shot of investment to go after the new product without necessarily being in a position to de-risk this kind of product innovation process.
And that third way is made with a knock on wood, a deep breath, a little holy water maybe. Yes.
Real business is real risky.
So enter the new Food Processing Innovation Center. How would this help the situation?
The center is going to be a place where firms can come and set up a new processing line all the way from inputs to consumer packaged goods. And it's going to be fully certified in terms of all of the regulations of FDA, USDA, et cetera, so that once you have produced products on this line, then you're going to be able to sell those products into test markets. And essentially, there is a rental fee, okay, for using the facility, but the rental fee and the opportunity to experiment takes a lot of the risk out of that new product development for these more middle-sized firms. And very often, these firms, because they're well-established in the marketplace, they already have a recognized brand name in many instances, they're able to dramatically grow if they have access to this kind of facility. And currently, there's no such facility here in the state of Michigan. And I would even argue there probably isn't one in the whole of the Great Lakes states.
Really? So this will be the first one?
This is a unique asset for our industry.
And so I take it there's a need, or you've assessed a need for this facility. Can you characterize that for us?
Yes. We part of the process of putting the business plan and feasibility study together is we did have to look at the market potential. And a very conservative estimate has shown us that there's somewhere between 600 and 700 firms here in the state of Michigan who would be potential clients for this kind of facility.
600 to 700 mid-sized firms. So we're talking, as you just said, 5 to 50 employees.
In that $5 to $20 million annual revenue.
That's quite a few. I imagine not many people had a concept that there's 600 to 700 companies like that in Michigan.
Well, we have a lot of food processing that goes on here in the state of Michigan. And the reason that that's true is because we have a tremendous diversity of agriculture in the state, so that the raw materials for a lot of different food processing operations are right here. In addition, we have plentiful water. Historically, we've had a strong labor force. There's all sorts of reasons to believe that Michigan could do even more in the processing arena, particularly if we could help these mid-sized firms. And in entrepreneurial speak, we tend to call them stage two firms, okay? If we can really give them the opportunity to grow, they could actually create very significant economic impacts. But they do need to be concerned that if they've got very good products and they're going to have customers come and say, can you do more for us? They want to be in a position to say, yes, we can do more.
Can you give us an example of how a company would use this and what situation this might come into play for a company?
Well, for example, you might have a well-established regional restaurant chain that actually has very good reputation for their products. And in this day and age, many of the key grocers are looking for new opportunities for local products on their shelves. And they could approach a restaurant chain and say, you know, these three entrees are extremely well known to consumers. Would you be willing to develop a quick, frozen, properly presented retail version of these entrees that you have? Well, most restaurant chains aren't going to have a spiral freezer to be able to create or even experiment with a quick frozen product like the grocer might want. And so this would be an ideal candidate for that company to come to us and say, we want to rent your facility for 2 weeks, up to 2 weeks, and really build the line, really see how this was done. We can make the first runs of the product. We will have refrigeration, freezer capacity right there as part of the facility. And then they build an inventory. They can sell down that inventory. They can come back sometime later in the year to do another run, for example. And as they build their business, eventually they move out of the incubator. But when they move out, they in essence have a complete floor plan for their new production line. And either virtually or physically, you take a snapshot of the production line and they can take it back and expand their existing facilities or build a new facility or whatever would be necessary to really take that business to the next level.
What is the potential economic impact of this center? Have you run some numbers?
Yeah, when you really take a look at the potential economic impact of, say, taking 20 ventures through this kind of operation a year, we're probably looking at upwards of 1,000 jobs created, and maybe as much as $300 to $400 million of sales. Now, that's a very rough estimate, but we think it is a doable estimate. Again, thinking about 20 stage two companies coming through the facility a year.
I'm Joe Lindstroth, and I'm speaking with Chris Peterson, a professor of agricultural, food, and resource economics, and the director of the MSU Product Center, which is overseeing the conception and construction of the new Food Processing and Innovation Center here on the MSU campus. Are there models of this type of thing elsewhere? You did mention that this could be the only one in the Great Lakes, but are there other models that you looked at across the country where folks are doing similar things?
Yeah, there are a number of places around the country where there are food technology centers, but they tend to be much more segregated in terms of the kinds of processes that they do. They'll tend to be either more emphasis on meat products or more emphasis strictly on fruits and vegetables, or they may look at particular kinds of processed goods. And very often they are arranged much more in a lab kind of configuration. And in addition, in most instances, those kind of facilities, particularly in, when connected to university, don't have all of the regulatory approvals to actually allow for the sale of product at the end of the production process in any event.
Will you be working with other MSU departments with the
center? Oh, my, yes. In my mind, the exciting part of this is MSU is practically unique in its ability to put together the scientific and technical support for a facility like this. So we potentially can work with faculty in food science and human nutrition, faculty that work with our meats lab and our dairy lab on campus, packaging faculty and ag bioengineering faculty that do lots of things with packaging and process design. And really, to be able to place this kind of facility near campus such that we can draw on that expertise, I think we really will have a unique ability to help spur the economic growth of food processing here in the state of Michigan.
And if everything goes as planned, Chris, when do you expect to be open?
We would hope that that by fall of 2015, we'd be up and running and we'd have a long line of businesses ready to come through.
Chris Peterson is a professor of agricultural, food, and resource economics and the director of the MSU Product Center, which is overseeing the conception and construction of the new Food Processing and Innovation Center here at MSU. Chris, thanks for joining me today.
You enjoyed it very much.
For Current State, I'm Joe Lindstroth.
And I'm Emmanuel Berry, in for Mark Bayshore. The second MSU Latin is America series got underway Wednesday and continues at campus locations and around the Lansing area through next Saturday, April 19th. Latin is America is a 10-day festival, which includes lectures, discussions, and concerts. Mark Sullivan and Ricardo Lorenz of the MSU College of Music met with WKAR's Peter Wharf earlier this week to talk about highlights of Latin is America. Lorenz kicked off the discussion by describing his U.S. premiere composition, Casarola Sol, which will be performed Sunday night at 7 at the MSU Fairchild Theater.
Casarola Sol, the soul of a frying pan, is a play on the word cacerolazo, which is the name given to these pot-banging protests that started in Chile in the 70s during mounting towards the overthrow of Presidente Allende, you know, by the military. So this piece is a tribute to these street protests and is a attempt to bring protests of the street that are very noisy and make it into a work of art for the concert hall. That's pretty much the way I would describe it. It has a choir. The choir sings words from a poem that I had to commission from a friend of mine because there was no literature out there about these street protests. And there's also a chamber ensemble, large percussion section that play pots and pans. The choir plays pots and pan, and it has a rapper as well.
So is there a pun with the word casserole and cacerola?
Yeah, because the word is cacerolazo. That is the word given to these pot-banging protests. And cacerola is casserole.
Yeah.
So when you say it in English, it sounds like cacerolazo. And it was actually Victor Marquez, our former DMA student, who we were talking, and he said, oh, cacerola soul. The soul of a frying pan. So I just stole that from him, and I thought it was a great way to bring two languages together, the word cacerola and soul, which is also part of this festival.
Right.
The symbiosis between the U.S. and Latin America.
Let's talk a little bit about the Cuban musicologist Miriam Escudero, who will be presenting lecture discussions on Tuesday, April 15th, and Thursday, April 17th. Mark, can you talk about her a little bit?
Well, I met her last spring when I went along with Ricardo and Rene Hinojosa to observe the study abroad program in Cuba. And it turns out that we went to visit one of her rehearsals, which was in one of the universities in Havana, and it's an early music group. And so one of the things that struck me when we encountered this group was that there were quite a few contratenors. And I was surprised, probably ridiculously, but I didn't expect to find such a group in Havana, Cuba. And they were performing, and we observed their rehearsal, and later I got to talk to her. And she is incredibly knowledgeable and articulate about early music, and it's a big passion with her, but she's also very well informed about contemporary Cuban music and culture and art and so forth. So we have some plans down the road and thought it might be good to bring her here to introduce her to David Rail. And next spring, she and David Rail are going to be conducting a program of early colonial music from Cuba and parts of Latin America with the orchestra and the chorus.
Yeah, and the story of Baroque music in Central and South America is a fascinating one, beginning in many ways with Spanish missionaries coming yep. here and bringing those Baroque traditions and melding them in many ways with indigenous populations.
Right.
And it's music that a lot of classical music fans may not be that familiar with, but should
Absolutely.
Know about because it's amazing music.
Even specialists in Latin American culture tend not to know much about the music from this period, and I don't want to steal the thunder of her talk, but she is going to be speaking about a musician who traveled from Mexico to Cuba during this time and sort of uses that as the lens for looking at this period about which many of us don't know much at all. And she's able to not only make us aware of that, but make us aware of it in a really fascinating way that connects the musical life with the cultural life with the colonial period. And it also looks at the impacts on today.
Sandra se va a responder a una duda.
¿Cómo es seguro?
Desde que eres mi mujer quisiera que de puro verte no te puedo.
One of the groups I'm really excited about is the Dalí Quartet, performing on Wednesday the 16th, and then Thursday the 17th in a Detroit concert with the MSU Community Music School in Detroit. This is a Philadelphia-based string quartet with an incredibly dynamic and exciting repertoire from some of the recordings I've heard. Philadelphia-based, but I gather a Venezuelan-born group. What's your connection?
Well,
Ricardo,
there's also a connection with MSU mm-hmm. because the first incarnation of the quartet had Miguel Rojas, who's a alumni of MSU, the cellist. I don't know if you remember Miguel.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think one of the violinists was also an MSU alumni. But they all moved to Philadelphia after doing their schools either at MSU or Indiana. They ended up in Philadelphia. They put together a string quartet and several years later, they're doing very, very well. Yes, three of the members now are Venezuelans, and one of them is Puerto Rican. I know all of them very well. They have a fantastic summer camp near Philadelphia that attracts some of the most talented young string players from all the East Coast, and they come from New York City, from Baltimore, from Washington, from Philadelphia. So they don't only are fantastic performers, but they're also community educators, that's a good word, and they're, that's part of their mission as well as the string quartet is to do community engagement activities. Therefore, that's where they're going to Detroit.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Ricardo Lorenz, assistant professor and area chair of composition for the College of Music at Michigan State University, and Mark Sullivan, assistant professor at the College of Music and director of computer music studies. Mark, you were saying before we started our conversation recording today that you like the variety of programming.
Yeah, that's actually
the edition of the series.
One of the goals of the series was to look at how Latin culture in the United States has begun more and more to sort of engage in a dialogue with Latin culture from other places. So we're trying in many different ways to sort of pull across the boundaries of genres and audiences and communities and get a closer and a more intimate mix and to show the real depth and beauty of a wide range of culture that encompasses classical, popular, folk, experimental, you name it.
Tejano Sound Band, which will wrap up the Latin is America series on Saturday, April 19th at 6 p.m. If you listen to WKAR's Ondas en Español on Saturdays and Sundays, then as a listener, you know a little bit about Tejano music because El Chayo features his music every weekend. But talk about that music and how it crosses over international and U.S. state borders from Mexico to Texas, East Texas, and even sort of a Cajun Louisiana influence to the sounds and rhythms.
And actually, that's what's going to kick that event off. So the musicians from Tejano Sound Band, some of them are going to be part of a panel along with Sheila Contreras and another representative from the community. And they're actually going to talk about the history of Tejano music, Tex-Mex music, and how it came to Michigan and how it's thriving still in Texas and sort of spreading around. After that, Ricardo mentioned that the Latin American tradition goes beyond just making music and includes food. And so on Saturday, we're having a dinner, a Mexican dinner, which will be followed by dancing. And again, we wanted to sort of mix up the kinds of events and not just have concert events, but actually have a real, you know, honest to goodness dance and a dinner. And to look at the range of social contexts in which you encounter music. So this was a perfect opportunity for that.
That's a quick look at the 2014 Latin is America Festival, a 10-day festival of music, artistic, and educational events celebrating the blending of Latin American and U.S. music and culture. Ricardo Lorenz is assistant professor and area chair of composition at the College of Music at Michigan State University. Mark Sullivan, assistant professor at the College of Music and director of computer music studios. Mark and Ricardo, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And that's our show for today. I'm Emmanuel Berry, in for Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.